Swansea Writers, all March 2026 stories. For 3 years, the paintings had been stacking up against the walls of Rhys's studio, mostly landscapes, the Preseli Hills under lowering skies, the Tafey estuary at low tide, the Pembrokeshire cliffs captured in thick, honest brushstrokes. Everyone agreed they were beautiful. The bank statements confirmed they were unsellable. The BWTN colony had 8 members left. There had been 20, once. She walked in on a Tuesday in March, her bright American accent cutting through the warm, sharp smell of linseed oil. "Megan Price," she said, extending a hand. "Tourism Wales. Here to make the rest of the world fall in love with the place." Rhys showed her around, mostly to be polite. She stopped in front of the estuary piece for a long time. "How much?" 300. "I'll give you 5, but I want to use it in a campaign that launches in April." He almost said no. Something old and stubborn in him rose up to refuse. Then the stack of canvases caught his eye, and he thought of Katrin next door, who hadn't sold anything since autumn. The campaign went everywhere. Bus shelters in Manchester, Instagram feeds in Ohio, a double-page spread in Condé Nast Traveller. Find the view that found him first. People did. By the end of March, Rhys had sold 11 paintings. A gallery in Cardiff called, then one in Bristol. Geraint confronted him at the colony's monthly meeting, standing with his arms folded, chin forward. "You've sold out. You're a capitalist." The room went quiet. 7 pairs of eyes waited. "Well, 6.5. Jim lost one eye in a brush accident 30 years ago." Rhys looked at his old friend, at the paint under his fingernails, at the pride that had kept them all poor and righteous for years. "Maybe I have," he said. "But I'm also buying." He laid a cheque on the table, enough to cover the colony's rent for 2 years. He had already purchased Katrin's estuary study, Priya's portraits, and Hugh's strange little abstracts, pieces nobody ever really understood, but that everyone secretly admired. Geraint looked at the cheque. His arms unfolded, slowly, like a bird getting ready to take flight. The tourists came that summer. Some of them found the colony, climbed the crooked stairs, and stood in the same rooms where the paintings had been made. A few bought things, then more than a few. By August, there were 12 members. By autumn, 16. In October, Katrin found Rhys cleaning brushes in the courtyard. "What a month March was," she said. "When you think about it, everything changed in March." Rhys squeezed the last of the turpentine from a brush and held it up to the light. "March," he said with a smile, "it's just another day. A Tuesday." She looked at him with quizzical eyes. "Moth," he said. "Tuesday, or March, if you prefer. Good in taffeta." It was after the phone call informing me of the 6th divorce that I looked into my family history. Sure enough, my mother confirmed I'm from a long line of Badderman bridesmaids. We stretch out through time like twisted trees in a forest. Every single union attended by one of us as part of the wedding party has ended, sooner or later, in divorce. But damn, do we look good in taffeta. I can only assume that's why people choose us. There's no denying it. What looks frumpy on most people frames us perfectly. And however garish the colours, the dresses light our complexions with a soft glow. It makes for stunning wedding photos. They speak to us. That's our gift. Or curse, depending on which way you look at it. We're the vessel through which the dresses channel their bitterness. Yes, bridesmaid dresses are resentful creatures. It stands to reason. They're always playing second fiddle, always in the background, and usually ridiculed. It isn't just taffeta, of course, although that's the loudest. Even the slinky, silky numbers whisper dark curses. I thought I imagined it the first time. I was just a kid. But I was pretty sure that the wedding march wasn't supposed to be, "Here comes the bride, I give it 5 years." The dresses didn't just look flattering. They whispered compliments and affirmations, and they made me feel so good inside and out that I couldn't turn down a bridesmaid request. "Darling, you look fabulous," they'd chant. They seemed to know when the brides annoyed me too, and they were always on my side. She just wants you to look bad. That's why she's asking you to attend to her when you haven't even done your own hair yet. Who does she think she is? Don't worry, the groom will lose interest once the first child is born. Those were the words a little off-the-shoulder midi dress said to me in 2007. How do I feel about brides, I hear you ask? I'm happily married myself and harboured absolutely no animosity towards any of the family and friends whose trains I carried down the aisle over the years. Not more than the usual, anyway. The first bars of Pachelbel's Canon in D start up, and I stand with the rest of the congregation. In my defence, I did warn my sister-in-law when she asked my daughter to be bridesmaid. "Look, Stace," I said, "this might sound strange, but the women in my family aren't lucky bridesmaids. Are you sure you want to?" "But Isabel will look perfect in that soft pink, and her eyes match the chair covers. You can't say no," she said in that whiny tone only used by brides-to-be. "Suit yourself," I replied. Now I watch with a tear in my eye as Stacy passes, Isabel floating behind in her slipstream. A faint whisper. The silk train ripples and crackles in her hand. Isabel smiles at me, walks on. It's picture perfect and so doomed, the sleep of reason. It was feelings of both fight and flight that hastened Veronica's trip to Milan. She urgently needed time away to collect her thoughts and prepare for an inevitable fight to come. Already she had mapped out her problem on a series of mental index cards. Simon, nightmares, feedback from friends, and exit. In the hotel, the task began in earnest. First card, Simon. Simon said he wanted to marry her. He had started to move things into her flat. Money went missing, and statements showed withdrawals she couldn't recall making. He denied knowledge. Evenings with friends were interrupted by Simon turning up and being rather abrasive. He always seemed to know where she was. She began to be edgy and wary of him. She wanted him to leave. Second card, nightmares. These were filled with creatures that lived on humans. Tapeworms, bedbugs, scabies, head lice, leeches. It took her a while to associate the word parasite with the dreams. She kept a postcard of Goya's etching. The sleep of reason produces monsters. No bats or owls in hers, but she did feel some affinity with the strangeness of Goya's dream. Third card, friends. Veronica knew her friends were less than happy with Simon and offered observations. Are you sure he isn't tracking your movements through your phone and stalking? Have you asked him about the cash that went missing? Why doesn't he pay some rent or buy some food? Why is he so suspicious of your mates? Fourth card, exit. A bold sunset plan was required here, which was beginning to take shape. After a parasite-free sleep, Veronica walked through the city. The Prado was not far, and Goya beckoned. To her side, she thought she caught a glimpse of Simon. Perhaps he really was keeping track of her. She saw him disappear behind a wall. The index cards began to merge. After a tour of the Goyas in their sundry locations, Veronica headed for the gift shop and bought a reasonable print of the nightmare etching and a large postcard of the same image. In the cafe sat Simon. No surprise. No euros for a coffee fifth, don't suppose. Oh dear, well I expect they'll give us something on the plane. In the airport lounge, Veronica's exit plan took form. She called a friend with a request to get her door lock changed urgently and asked her to meet up at Bristol Airport. After this, she removed the SIM from her phone. On the plane, with Simon St. Rose in front, she wrote the following message on the Sleep of Reason postcard. Simon, we are over. Please return the money you have taken from me. Stop stalking me or I shall need to inform the police about your efforts at coercion and theft. Veronica. She planned to drop this on his tray as she left the plane. As she looked down, two louse-like creatures crawled from her rolled-up poster. She had great satisfaction, squashing them between her thumbnails. Museum of... The Aboriginal spear looked unsettled in its pristine glass case. Visitors circled it like an enemy surrounding its prey. Kangaroo skin, they murmured after reading the description. 17th century. I wonder if they used it to kill emus, they continued, before drifting away. David stood nearby, rolling his eyes inwardly. As a security guard at the Museum of Ethnic Art, it was easy for him to hide in plain sight, not unlike his Aboriginal ancestors did in the scrub, when hunting using a spear like the one displayed. David recognised this weapon, a woomera, as one used by his people for hunting, fishing, fighting, punishment, and as a symbolic marker of masculinity. It felt like the ultimate insult for it to be trapped in a glass case in a stuffy Sydney museum. The collective sadness of his tribe, the Gulpili people of the Larrakia region in northwest Queensland, thrummed in his body. Every night he heard their voices calling him to make amends. As a light-skinned man with an English name inherited from his grandfather's owners, the museum staff did not recognise David's aboriginality. He presented as a reliable, somewhat introverted worker. However, for David, performing this job was a radical act. Every day his blood boiled as he walked past the huge sign, Museum of Ethnic Art, in bold, red letters. Ha! He thought, we are the original owners of this land and now we are ethnic. The Aboriginal artefacts were lumped together with the East Asian collection, also victims of colonial era looting. How were everyday functional objects like lamps and teapots considered art? Fumed David. He empathised with the rightful owners of these items but needed to focus on his own mission. It was almost too easy. Signing up for the afternoon closing shift. Giving notice to his landlord before packing spray cans and his personal belongings into a canvas bag. Before donning his uniform, David painted his chest with a mixture of charcoal, ochre and animal fat. The markings a symbol of kinship and ancestral authority. At shift close, he locked the doors, turned off the security cameras and unlocked the glass case using the security key. David held the spear, breathless, in a moment that felt both ancient and defiant. But his work was not over. Taking the bag with his precious treasure, he climbed onto the museum roof. The lights of the harbour bridge twinkled across the inky sky, the creamy sails of the Opera House sails catching the moonlight. David carried his spray cans as he carefully trod the scaffolding bridge. His breathing heightened to warrior mode as he sprayed a black score through. The letters ETHNIC. Switching to red paint, can he sprayed the letters STOLEN directly below them. David stepped back, triumphant as the word stolen bled slowly down the white wall. Below him, the harbour glittered, while ferries moved across the dark water like slow ghosts. Creation. Jed Newton? The hospital? Yes, that's right, the wife's on the list. We was told she'd be a proper good match in the right circumstances, but... What? An opportunity has... I'm not following you, mate. Listen now, she was informed the chances weren't great due to the rarity of... What? A dying woman has what... Are you saying Tracy can have her womb transplant? I went there, Jed, and they're sure I'm suitable. The head on me's reeling. I've never got my hopes up, no, but now it seems it'll happen, and I keep thinking of her, I do, though I don't know her name, nor nothing of her, except she's about to die. Some part of me doesn't want that, but a selfish part does. Three organs for donation she's authorised, but a womb, see? Falls outside of normal consent. It's the family who've decided hers can be used. The hospital rang them and they immediately agreed. Jed, we finally have a chance. I call her Donna. Donna the donor. Her womb is in me now. Must start thinking of it as my womb. Transplant successful and soon fertility treatment will begin. Today's my 30th. Wonder what age she was. Real kindness from her family that. I don't have the words to thank them, even if I knew who they were. They've allowed a complete stranger to fulfil her dream of becoming a mum. And if Jed and I are fortunate, the hospital team are optimistic, I can then try for more children. Not just one. Years of no hope. Blown away. We're going to have a family. I get emotional thinking about it. I do. That little voice within that kept saying it's all make-believe has gone. It's real. There's a photo online and in the papers of a smiling mother and... Infant, Tracy and Emma thank dead donor. My husband, John, just shakes his head. is that in amazement at this byproduct of our daughter's passing, it's more likely the loss of her, less than a year ago and still raw for us. John went upstairs after looking at the photo. He often sits down on the bed and stares into space, seeing Philippa somewhere outside the window, beyond the suburban streets, beyond the surrounding countryside, maybe even beyond the distant sea. He wants her to return. Losing Philippa broke us into thousands of fragments. We still find them daily, jagged, hurtful, ripping. But today I've glimpsed her legacy, a miracle birth due to the selflessness of the donor's parents, Tracy said. Philippa, a single mother, left one other item to the world, her son, Tom, six now, her final gift to us, unexpected yet treasured. Just one dark cloud. I need to share with John my scan results. Not yet, though. He has enough worries. Soon, because I'm very concerned. I'm glad he went along with my suggestion of the womb donation. Leaving something for others after you die is good. Yes, good. The ART of chaos. Hearing the side gate opening, Mavis sighed. What's happened now? Mitzi, Mavis's poodle, raised her head and groaned and disappeared behind the sofa. Puffing into sight was Eva, her daughter-in-law with the twins in their buggy. Thankfully, they appeared to be asleep. She stomped in. You'll never believe what your waster of a son has done now. Cup of tea, love? Mavis tried to fix her face, wishing she could disappear with Mitzi. Since having the twins, Eva had moaned about everything, mostly about Adam, Mavis's son. The poor lad worked all the hours to provide for his family, but it was never enough. Setting the cups down, she waited for the tirade that must follow. You know I went out for lunch with the girls Saturday, fed the kids before I left, so all he had to do was watch them. I got home about 9, and that waster was fast asleep on the sofa. The safety gate was wide open, my lounge was chaos, sweet wrappers strewn around everywhere. My God, the kitchen, every cupboard open. Charlotte must have worked out how to open the safety locks. She's only 6. Honestly, what will she do next? The floor was covered in chocolates, dog biscuits, crisps. Anything that was edible had been nibbled. Dallas and Mog whined at the patio doors. I noticed their whiskers were bright blue. There was a red stain around their mouths and several shades of pink and purple. I opening the doors and they shot out, looking at me like it was my fault. Adam didn't know what hit him. I pushed him off the sofa and we had a right Barney. Before Eva could draw breath, Mavis dived in. I offered to have the three of them here for the evening, but you turned me down. Eva huffed. Adam has to do his share. They are his kids, too. I don't ask much. Hey, I haven't told you the worst part. Upstairs, the three of them fast asleep on my bed, covered in makeup, nail varnish, and my expensive perfume, jewellery flung around. A right mess, I sat and cried. Took me ages to get the nail varnish off Denver and Austin. Thankfully, they had their night nappies on. Charlotte tried to blame the dog. Honestly, she is definitely her father's child, a total whirlwind causing chaos. Mavis stood up. Eva, you know that Adam works hard to give you all a comfortable life. I know having 2-year-old twins and a 6-year-old is hard work, which is why I offer to have them. Please don't rant about my son to me. I know how much he does for you all. Now the twins are waking up. Maybe you should take them home. The silence echoed through the room. Eva turned, stalking out of the door. Mavis sat and with head in her hands cried silent tears. Mitzi crept out next to her and licked her tears. Art is sacred. Harlan Ray dismissed modern culture as a lot of gay shit and longed for everyone to agree. You faggots ever heard of Buster Keaton? He'd scream. Son of a bitch wasn't human. He was a refugee from the planet Krypton. Christ, everybody these days thinks they're a genius when Hollywood should come with a disclaimer. Only superhumans need apply. Harlan needed a protege, a successor, somebody who'd swallow his nuggets of wisdom, and the studio's most promising wunderkind was the sullen and silent Frank Childs. I've got no love for drawing, Frank had shrugged. It pays the bills and I've got a knack for it, but it's not like I'm curing cancer here. Harlan, however, feeling that Frank needed an education, took the lad to what he called the Hall of Heroes, a derelict music venue which in its day had seen Orson Welles storm upon its stage, along with Charlie Chaplin and plenty of other greats. "You know my philosophy," Ray had said as he unlocked the front doors to the decaying hall. Frank surmised it without blinking. The first half of the 20th century was the pinnacle of human accomplishments. If anything comes from that era, assume it's great unless Harlan Ray says otherwise. If anything is modern, assume it's crap unless Harlan Ray says otherwise. Nah, Ray snapped back. You've got to respect the greats, kid. And remember, art isn't a hobby or a job. It's a vocation, a goddamn religion. And with that, he unlocked the rusty bolts, pushed open the doors to the mausoleum with a groan. Frank, though, winced at the stagnant smell of dust and dry rot. The windows were either boarded up or broken, but the rays of the midday sun still poured into the empty hall. This once grand establishment felt like an odd cross between a church and a radio hall. Its white walls were stained, and the Art Deco organ had rusted considerably. As Frank worried if there was asbestos in the air, Harlan Ray fell to his knees and saw Shakespeare, Mozart, Laurence Olivier, and a gazillion of his heroes' ghosts standing upon the stage. Frank raised his eyebrow at this display. "We're not regular humans, Frank," Harlan explained. "We're artists. Art has been stolen by completely ordinary people no different from your local milkman. You have the truly exceptional folk being shoved to the back of the bus." Frank made a pained expression. "My dad's a doctor. He's saved actual lives." "As for us, we're no Übermensch. We draw doodles." Harlan ripped open his shirt to reveal his hairy beer-bellied chest. "Live through me. Live through me. Keaton, Chaplin, Lloyd, live through me. I am your vessel. I am your ambassador. I shall make art creative again. Live through me, goddammit." And Frank Childs looked up at the empty stage and shrugged, knowing that nobody gets into heaven on how good their art is.